Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about Afghanistan. And our guest for the show is Dr. Seth Jones. He's a political scientist who does analysis of Afghanistan, of terrorism for the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. He's been there as recently as March. And we'll be talking this morning about conditions there in Afghanistan, particularly about the resurgence as a fighting force of the Taliban. Back in 2001, a coalition of American and Afghan troops overthrew the Taliban regime. And at that time, it was the judgment of the United States that the Taliban had been damaged to the point that they would no longer be a threat. However, it wasn't very long before the Taliban reformed and launched an insurgency attacking the current government of Afghanistan. It's now estimated that the Taliban perhaps control as much as 10% of the country, and certainly attacks against the government and against NATO forces there in Afghanistan have increased, particularly over the last couple of years. We'll be talking a little bit about what it is that explains the rise of this insurgency, and perhaps also what the United States government and other governments can do to strengthen the Afghan government. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to be a part of the conversation, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you might be listening across the country on the Internet, either way, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, it's 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can get in as many different people as possible. But of course, anybody who is listening is welcome to call. Dr. Jones, hello.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly do appreciate it. I suppose the place to start, this is obviously a large question, but it is the central question. And how is it that we got to the point, from the point where the government, the United States government, was essentially saying that we believe that the Taliban has been broken to the point that they're not going to be a problem anymore and we just don't have to worry about it, to the point now where it's a resurgent force? It does pose a significant threat to the U.S. forces there and other forces there, a part of the NATO coalition, a threat to the government of Afghanistan. And it's particularly gotten particularly worse over the last couple of years. What happened here?
Well, I think there are at least two factors that are driving the rise of Afghanistan's insurgency. One of them has to deal with governance and local Afghan governance. And I think one of the things we've seen over the past few years is increasing challenges in the provision of essential services to local Afghans, electricity, water, roads, as well as security to Afghans through the Afghan National Police and Afghan National Army and other Afghan national security forces. So challenges along those lines in providing services to the local population as well as protecting them. And challenges, especially in rural areas of the country, have tended to ostracize many local Afghans that are questioning their government's ability to provide these services and protect them. And this, it turns out, is quite common across many insurgencies. The center of gravity is the local population. And I think this is no different here. The second issue gets to be outside support, and that is from the U.S. and other international standpoint, the levels of assistance to Afghanistan, whether they're military forces, amounts of money, have been ironically among the lowest of any nation-building or even counterinsurgency operations since 1945. So I think this is partly caused by the U.S. war in Iraq, which took a lot of the resources from the Afghan front and put them in other places. And the second part of this outside support is what you did see in the aftermath of the 2001 overthrow of the Taliban regime was an exodus of Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and other militants into neighboring Pakistan, where they were able to link in with a whole range of extremist groups. So I think just to summarize, what you do have is governance challenges, And then too little support to the Afghan government, too much support to Afghan insurgents.
Well, we can return to some of these things and perhaps talk about them in some detail. I don't want to be completely negative, however, at least to start out. What can one say that would be positive about what it is that the current government of Afghanistan has managed to accomplish?
Well, I think there are a few things. One is the state of the economy actually is continues to be pretty good. I mean, Afghanistan started in 2001 from a very low economic baseline. Over the past few years, some of the growth rates have been higher even than those in some of the countries we look at across the world, like China, that have the most significant and skyrocketing GDPs. So the economic front looks decent. Inflation is relatively low in Afghanistan. And the Afghan government has tried to deal with some of these challenges, like governance, over the past year, I think, somewhat more effectively by paying a lot more attention to who the key governors and sub-district governors are across the country through through a new office that's been established right under President Karzai. So I think on a number of fronts, there certainly are some positive steps from the Afghan government's perspective. There's no question. And then if you do look at areas of the country, such as northern Afghanistan, insurgency really hasn't taken root there. There have been some interfactional fighting among militia commanders, but not a lot of what you'd call major insurgency. So the security situation is mixed across the country.
According to some of the figures that I've seen, the estimates are that the Taliban controls maybe about 10% of the country, that the government controls about 30%, and that would include the capital, Kabul. Then the question comes, who controls the other 60%?
Well, how you measure control of territory is extremely difficult because what happens both with Afghan international forces as well as with Taliban and a whole range of other insurgent groups is they often don't control territory in the sense of having their militia forces patrol areas. They work out deals with local tribes. So in most cases, it actually is influence in rural areas of the country rather than control. But I think what tends to be pretty clear is both the international community, that is NATO and U.S. forces, as well as Afghan forces, tend to control urban areas, Kabul and a range of other cities across Afghanistan. When you get into rural areas of the country, a lot of that territory is up for grabs. And so what you see is control or influence tends to be in the hands at a very local level among militia commanders or among a range of sort of local militia groups rather than insurgent groups or the U.S. and other NATO forces.
You've been talking a little bit earlier about one of the challenges that the government faces, particularly outside of the cities, is to take care of people's basic needs. And I think also that can be a problem even in Kabul as well, that there are people who complain that they don't have electricity and they don't have access to clean water and we don't have a functioning sewage system, that's a serious, as you say, that's a serious issue for the government to deal with. How much of that, particularly outside of the capital, has to do with security issues the difficulty of the government to deal with that? And how much of it do you think is a matter of resources perhaps goes to this other issue that you said, that the levels of support for the government coming from outside, despite whatever promises have been made, really wasn't adequate to meet the need?
Well, that's a good question. If you look at Afghanistan, just to be clear here, most of the insurgency is happening in areas of the south, that is provinces like Kandahar and Helmand, the east, a range of provinces like Paktia, Kunar, and then some areas of central Afghanistan, some of the provinces around Kabul, as well as some areas of the west, especially southern Herat province. And so what you see, though, is as you pointed out earlier, part of the problem with these services, electricity, water, and governance, is in insecure areas, again, like the east or the south of Afghanistan, it becomes extremely difficult for civilian organizations and even militaries to get out and build things because they do come under threat from attack. So whether you're building a school or a health clinic or a road, a dam like the Kajaki Dam in Helmand, there is a major security threat. And what you see is a lot of development agencies, whether it's the U.S. Agency for International Development or the a range of agencies from Canada, Britain, and other countries that are operating in these areas, there are major restrictions on their ability to get out, work on projects, monitor projects. They need military escorts in most places they go in these areas. So it does become a fundamental problem to do reconstruction and development work in areas that are fundamentally insecure.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Seth Jones. He's a political scientist who works for the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C., is interested in events in Afghanistan as well as generally the subject of nation building and terrorism. We're talking this morning about Afghanistan and what's going on there today. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You, sir, in your initial kind of summation about what was going on, you pointed to what is, I think in a lot of people's minds, a very serious issue, maybe one of the biggest ones, and that is the fact that after the defeat of the Taliban, that they and al-Qaeda managed to move across the border of Afghanistan into Pakistan. And they are based there today and managed to operate from there. And there certainly has been a lot of criticism of the government of Pakistan and its failure to assist in dealing with Taliban and al-Qaeda in these regions. Just how serious a problem is that, and is that truly something that we should expect the government of Pakistan to do something about?
Well, I think the sanctuary issue is a very serious one. What you have in Afghanistan at the moment is really a regional insurgency or a regional series of insurgencies. As you go up and down the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, you get over a dozen groups. They range not just from Taliban and al-Qaeda, but include virtually a dozen additional groups, Hezb Islami, the Haqqani Network. And with virtually all of these groups, they have a presence both on the Afghan and the Pakistan side of the border, including in most cases the command and control structure to the degree that it exists is often on the Pakistan side of the border because they're harassed less by security forces there. Which leads me to two points. One is I still think it's important to understand that most of the problems that the U.S., NATO, and the Afghan government are facing in Afghanistan are internal problems. That is, there are reconstruction and development problems within Afghanistan. Not all of Afghanistan's problems. Most of them are not external. But the sanctuary problem, which is the second point, is fundamental. The ability of groups to bring improvised explosive devices, suicide bombers, logistical supplies, arms, and ammunition from a range of areas in Pakistan, the Northwest Frontier Province, the federally administered tribal areas, Baluchistan Province, across the border into Afghanistan is significant. It's led to a number of comments publicly by General Dan McNeil, now the former four-star commander of U.S. and other NATO forces in Afghanistan. He said this as recently as last week. So this problem is fundamental, and this really needs to be a U.S., other international, and Pakistan response to dealing with insurgents on the Pakistan side of the border. But it is a fundamental problem, and I think as long as these sanctuaries exist, there will continue to be instability in Afghanistan.
Just one other question. I think it's generally believed that the government of Pakistan had a role in establishing the Taliban and were supporting the Taliban for some time. I guess basically because they were interested in having in neighboring Afghanistan a regime, a client regime, or at least a regime that they had some influence on. And now at this point, do you think that it is the case that it's simply that the government of Pakistan is maybe less than enthusiastic about helping out to go after Taliban and al-Qaeda that are in this region of Pakistan that's along the border? Or does it go beyond that? Is the government of Pakistan or perhaps some elements within the Pakistani military security services actually somehow supporting these elements?
Good question. It's extremely difficult to generalize about any security agency in Pakistan because there are multiple organizations and obviously different views within those organizations, whether you're talking about intelligence or army or the paramilitary frontier corps. But what you see is two things. One is there does appear to be a hesitancy in dealing in a Pakistani response to Afghan and Pakistan militant groups. So there is an unwillingness, I think, to conduct military and police operations against groups like the Taliban that are operating in Pakistan, whether it's Mullah Omar's Taliban operating out of places like Quetta, which is in Balochistan, or even in some of the areas around Peshawar. I think an unwillingness for a range of domestic, political, and other reasons why there's an unwillingness to conduct really sustained operations against these organizations.
Mm-hmm. And how much – forgive me for interrupting. I don't know how much time you spent looking at Pakistani politics, but the fact that the government of Pakistan itself now is in such disarray, I suppose there are some people who might argue that there really isn't one. How much does that complicate the ability of Pakistan to address this issue?
Well, I think it fundamentally complicates the issue because what it does, I think, is it means individuals, senior Pakistani officials spend a lot of time trying to figure out who's running the government, what to do on major policy issues like the Supreme Court, rather than dealing with internal security issues like what to do with the federally administered tribal areas. Mm-hmm. So I think it has a fundamental impact.
We are getting close to our midpoint here. I have several callers. In fact, the lines are full, and we'll get right to them. We'll just, again, ask people to help us out by being brief in their comments. That way we can get in as many people as possible. Our guest is Seth Jones. He's a political scientist who works for the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about Afghanistan. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. First caller is in Muhammad, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I've always been curious in these places where there's, you know, so much trouble and insurgency, why the insurgents would attack infrastructure improvements. It seems like that's something that just benefits all, including them, how they can maintain support when they're doing those types of things.
Very good question. Why attack infrastructure if it appears to really positively impact everyone? Well, I think the major difference in the areas where you see infrastructure targeted is really an ideological projects that where there is an ideological disagreement. That is, girls' schools in Pashtun areas of Afghanistan, where there really is a strong view among some of the militant groups that girls should not be educated, certainly should not go to school, and so girls' schools have been targeted. Second, I do think projects that are orchestrated by the international community, really the enemy, are often targeted because if they're successful, that then may be a strategic defeat for militant groups. So I think it's done for two reasons. One is I think there are cases where there are ideological divisions between militant groups and those working on the development projects. And second, I think there is concern among a range of groups like the Taliban that if the West and its international organizations are successful in projects, that's a victory for them at the expense of insurgent groups.
Well, thank you for your answer.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line number two for another caller in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, please. Mm-hmm. A couple of things I'd like you to examine. One is the nature of the tribal areas, the border areas in Pakistan. For most of history, that area was more closely identified with Afghanistan than with India and later Pakistan. It was only in the recent history that India managed to gain control or nominal control of the area. And when they were forced to withdraw from the subcontinent, they ceded sovereignty to Pakistan. Actually, I think probably it was India at the time. But that those people in that area probably see themselves as much Afghani as they do, more so than they do Pakistani. The other is the nature of the initial attack on Afghanistan. We used an incredibly small force and relied upon the discredited Mujahideen to hold the ground. And it seems to me this almost ensured the failure of the program. They had been so corrupt in the past that nobody had any use for them. And they were utterly incapable of working together. Probably the high point or low point of this was at Tora Bora, when we actually managed to trap most of bin Laden's people. And we sent the Afghanis in, who had no interest in taking them. And they simply went in and let them escape.
Yeah, both good questions, and both actually quite interlinked, too. On the tribal nature, actually, I would argue that when you do get into the border areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan, what's much more important than identification as Afghans or Pakistanis is the identification at the tribe, sub-tribe, clan level. So most people, and I was just along the border in May of 2008, last month, the identification tends to be, you know, we identify ourselves as Waziris or Masuds or a range of other sub-clans or tribes. And so I think that actually is what you find is there's a lot of decentralized authority that people identify themselves at a tribal level, not in terms of an actual nationality. And second, on the initial attacks in Afghanistan, there clearly was an effort by U.S. Special Forces and the CIA to focus on working with local tribal groups. And, you know, it was a successful strategy in 2001, where it began to make life difficult for the U.S. over the next few years, is there still was a lot of effort on providing support to local warlords and militia commanders. And I think this was probably unhelpful in retrospect, rather than working on, in those early years, building up the competence of the Afghan national security forces and the government itself, at the expense of warlords. But you did see a lot of U.S. money pouring into local warlord commanders who profited significantly in 2002 and 3 and 4 from U.S. funding.
Well, do you think that is the case? As some people would argue that the problem here is that perhaps not so much that initially, there weren't enough U.S. troops there, but that over time, as the United States was preparing for the Iraq War, that very quickly started to drain off some of the prime resources from Afghanistan, and that perhaps if the focus hadn't been diverted by Iraq, and if the main thing here had been Afghanistan, that do you think things would be better than they are? Better now than they are.
Well, I think a lot of the challenges that the U.S. faces in Afghanistan now are a result of issues related to governance within Afghanistan. But I do think, to be fair, there is something of a zero-sum game between Afghanistan and Iraq, and that is additional mentors for training Afghan National Police and Afghan National Army. There are vacuums and a need for significantly more mentors in the field. Those would have to come, as the military now says, from Iraq. Predators that are coming off the production line either go towards Afghanistan, Iraq. CIA has to think very carefully about who it's sending to Iraq or Afghanistan. And so I do think there's been a lot of focus over the last two, three, 4 years on Iraq at the expense of Afghanistan. Now, if you look, for example, at levels of forces, Afghanistan is a bigger country geographically. It has a larger population. It has one-third, less than one-third of the forces that exist in Iraq at the moment. So I do think there is something of a trade-off. And I would actually argue it is certainly not the only factor that one needs to look at. But spending more time and putting more resources, including forces, into Afghanistan would have been helpful as early, frankly, as 2002.
Let's go to another caller. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Much of the rest of the world, and I think increasing numbers in this country, regard the U.S. and NATO as having about as much right in Afghanistan as Russia did, or maybe as Germany did in Poland in 1940. The war is a war for American geopolitical interests, and I think before long, more Americans are going to say that we should not be there, and that a withdrawal, like Russia's withdrawal, is in the cards. The ability of the U.S. government to sell this war to the American populace, I think, is declining rapidly.
Well, that's an excellent question. I think the what you ironically see at the moment, though, is some of the more recent intelligence estimates that have become public, like the intelligence estimate on security threats to the homeland that came out in 2007, placed the primary threat to the U.S. homeland from international terrorist groups in the Afghan-Pakistan tribal areas. It's al-Qaeda, bin Laden, Zawahiri, based out of the federally administered tribal areas and other areas of Afghanistan. I would argue as long as that threat exists to the U.S., there will be a selfish strategic interest in continuing to focus on this area because there is a perceived threat to the U.S. homeland. So I do think that's that will drive American foreign policy over the next 5 to 10 years. On the Russian example, the key factor I would argue that we have to look at is how the local population feels. And the levels of support for the U.S. and the international community, like the UN, were extremely high in the early phases, 2001, 2002. Those numbers still tend to be over 50% of local support, the presence of U.S. and other international forces and actors in Afghanistan. But the numbers have been declining for a range of reasons. So that is something I think that is definitely worth watching. Public opinion polls, how do local Afghans feel about the international role, including the U.S. role? That's a fundamental issue to monitor as we, I think, progress in Afghanistan.
These 2 points, I think, contrast with one another. After the Bush administration's behavior in regard to Iraq, I think the argument that the U.S. is somehow engaged in self-defense in Afghanistan or in Iraq looks pretty threadbare. I mean, no one believes that anymore, however much the administration, the old one or the new one, uses it to say we're defending ourselves against terrorism here. I mean, this is nonsense. The U.S. has had a generations-long policy of wanting to control Middle East energy resources, and ever since 9/11, we've used the threat of terrorism as a justification for what the rest of the world recognizes as our geopolitical concerns. Your second point about what the local population wants, I think, is much more important. I mean, we know, for example, that's overwhelming in Iraq right now, that the Iraqis want the Americans out, and even Iraqis who've suffered from civil war in that country still want, at a level of 80% want the Americans out. Harder to take account in Afghanistan, but certainly one of the things the phrase "the rise of the Taliban" covers is the actual increase in the number of Afghanis who want the foreign invaders out. And in our media, of course, people like this are called terrorists or Taliban, but they have very little to do with seminary students and a great deal to do with local Afghans who simply want the invaders to get out, as they have literally for centuries.
Well, 2 points along these lines. One is at the moment, virtually all the public opinion polling that's been done from organizations like the Asia Foundation indicates that support for Taliban is either in single digits or in the teens. So it appears to be quite low. In fact, what appears to be going on is the Afghan support for the Afghan government appears to be declining rather than significant levels of support for the Taliban. So in a sense, there's a competition for very low levels of support. But one of the things that's interesting in the debate in Washington on Afghanistan among both Democrats and Republicans is there appears to be a strong push for greater resources. And I have not seen a single poll in the United States which strongly suggests that the American population wants to pull out of Afghanistan. In fact, what you see on the funding levels, both from Democrats and Republicans, is actually quite the reverse. Now, it's certainly possible that if a new administration focuses more on the Afghan-Pakistan front, you may see a similar response to what you've seen in Iraq, which is declining levels of American support for the war there. But I've never seen any evidence of that phenomenon taking place for Afghanistan, at least yet.
I have to jump in here. We're headed into our last 15 minutes, and we have three callers yet to go. I want to introduce our guest, Seth Jones. He's a political scientist with the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C., was in Afghanistan as recently as May
2008, that's correct.
Just in May of this year, and is also interested in Afghanistan and in also issues of nation building and terrorism. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Montgomery, Illinois. This is our toll free line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, this is a good topic. I kind of agree with the gentleman before me, and as such, you know, but I'll add something to it. We're not a nation of nation builders. We should not be interfering with anybody else. And I can bring up facts that there's, and this has been thrown out by Wolf Blitzer of CNN and a few other people, Lou Dobbs, Glenn Beck. There are more terrorists in other countries than there are in Afghanistan and in Iraq combined. Now, if we're going to go after terrorists, and this is a known fact, that most of the terrorists that hit us on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia, but yet we're still buddy-buddy with them. Secondly, I feel strongly enough to say whether we're, you know, we pull out of Iraq or Afghanistan or say, go into Afghanistan and go get them, it won't change anything one bit because right now, because of the previous administration, our name has been blackened. And the reason I say this is because I'm first-generation American. Most of my family lives in Europe. And everybody over there hates Americans. You don't hear one good thing about it. So I don't know where your surveys are coming from. But it's like basically they say in German, French, Dutch, Greek, Italian, you know, we're not a nation of nation builders. They basically feel that we're a dictatorship. We're equal to the evil empire, which Ronald Reagan called was Russia. Now, I'm not going to blame George Bush, and I'm not going to blame Clinton or anybody else. I'm just pointing out a fact that until we get off their oil, until we get off of their you know, we spend billions of dollars every year, trillions on these people. Until we stop spending money, we're always going to have these problems. And as far as Taliban and we forget about Hamas, and you know, Hamas is another mess. I mean, they want to annihilate everybody. It has nothing to do with whether you're American or Italian. Their idealism on how everybody in the world should live, and if you look this up, this is true. The Quran tells them killing is good. So anyway, I'll get off and let you let somebody else get on. Thanks.
All right. Well, there. I don't know if you want to pick some things out of there to respond to.
Sure. There were a number interesting points. One of them that I'll just pick up on is there clearly is a terrorist threat that's coming from multiple places in the world. There's a whole series of al-Qaeda linked organizations operating in North Africa that have conducted attacks in places like Tunisia and Morocco. There are also a range of militant groups operating out of places like Saudi Arabia. But what I would say on this front, though, is the preponderance of not just U.S. information across its agencies and its military, but also across Europe, strongly indicates a major threat to the U.S. homeland from the Afghan-Pakistan front. And what I'd argue, too, is if you look in July 2005, London was targeted. The London tubes were targeted by a network of individuals led by Mohammed Siddiqui Khan that had conducted training in Pakistan. In 2006, the transatlantic plot that was foiled, the whole reason when we get on airplanes we have to get rid of our liquids, was linked to militant groups operating out of the out of Pakistan's federally administered tribal areas. In 2007, we had a whole series of arrests in Germany and Denmark on militant groups, Uzbek militant groups with links back into training in Pakistan. And in 2008, both major arrests in Spain and France with attacks in Europe with links then back into Pakistan. So I think across Europe and the United States, there is a fundamental threat that comes from this area, and I think it's a particular concern.
Well, let's go to another call here. Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I heard Tariq Ali on American Airwaves, and he was actually well-received by a gentleman from the War College, Arkia, I guess is the fellow's name, who's also been to Afghanistan relatively recently. I don't know whether the antecedents of the RAND Corporation and the Air Force, maybe there's a schism between the analysis there. But I bring it up because it's in the New Left Review, and it proposes that really the only solution is a withdrawal and negotiation between the concerned parties in the region with U.N. Oversight, of course, but not this ISAF group. You're talking about the failing and the losing of the hearts and minds. A couple of things that you didn't refer to were, you know, the indiscriminate bombing. I guess the air power is called Big Daddy, as in bring Big Daddy in. But there's also, according to Barnett Rubin, really resentment against the alcohol consumption, which is, I guess, understandable, but also patronage of growing number of brothels. And there's also widespread reports of rape by ISAF forces. This is not widely reported, but it's Rawa, an Afghan women's group, asserts that this is the case. So there's more than a few threads there, too. But basically, I propose a much deeper analysis, and I'd like for you to address some of those concerns.
Sure, those are good points. I mean, and what you when you actually get into rural areas of Afghanistan, places where the insurgency has gotten some traction, in places like the south and the east, and now into central Afghanistan, you do see a whole range of reasons why individuals are supporting either tacitly or directly militant groups. In some cases, they actually may be coerced. That is, that there are there's Taliban penetration of areas where they are putting bullets in the back of people's heads, and you know you're coercing a local population. In other areas, you are seeing significant grievances among the against the Afghan government. But in other cases, as you point out, there are other reasons that are driving some to become fed up with the coalition or Afghan government, and that is the bombing campaign appears in some cases to have ostracized the local population. I think there has been an effort to reduce the amount of U.S. and other NATO air bombing of areas. I think it's partly a result of the lack of ground forces operating in some of these areas, that they're relying on air power. But I do think in some cases it clearly has had a detrimental impact. So I do think that some of the resentment that is coming from local Afghans has been because of policy decisions or actions by the international community, including some of the bombing campaigns. So I think it is right to point issues like that out.
What about the general idea that there is no real military solution and that it has to be some kind of provisional government, that the Karzai government, with its interpenetration of warlords, you know, there are warlords in the parliament, is never going to be a credible through for even a small percentage of the Afghan
Well, I think the history of both looking at how insurgencies are resolved and Afghan insurgencies are resolved indicates that there really are two roads where success, if that's the right word, is achieved. One of them is actually military defeat. And clearly with the Taliban in the 1990s, by the end of the 1990s, they militarily defeated every other group. So there is historical precedent for a battlefield solution. But we've also seen negotiated settlements. So I think in that case, you know, it's certainly possible to reach some sort of settlement with mid to lower levels of a range of militant organizations. But I would argue that at the top levels of virtually all the major organizations like the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, Hezbollah Islami, especially Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's, there is a very different vision of what Afghanistan should look like, an Afghanistan that looks much like what you saw in the 1990s, where women wear burqas, where women don't go to schools at all, a very a radical interpretation of Sunni Islam. And so I think in that sense, it will be very difficult to reconcile that view with what you see coming from the Karzai government. So there may be able to be some possibility of breaking away parts of the organization, but I don't think at the top levels of the Karzai government and some of the insurgent groups there will be ever a possibility of meeting of minds.
Well, I would contest your analysis of how the Taliban won. I don't think it was a simple military victory. I think it was provision of resources and supplies to the people. I mean, they were reprehensible in a lot of their political ideology, but they actually did take care to provide peace and order, which looked excellently good. And the polls that you cited about their popularity, I think is probably accurate, but I would dare say if it was phrased differently and they asked if they would prefer the stability that was and relative, not call it peace, but quietude of the Taliban regime, they would have, many would prefer it. This reflects also the Iraq situation where people are nostalgic for the Saddam regime. You also, I can understand why you might not want to do it, but the idea that Youssef is doing what most militaries do, can brothels and rape, it's not a pleasant thing to, and it's obviously controversial, and I think it you should at least mention it. Thanks.
Yeah, on that last issue, I have not seen any significant evidence on rape in particular. In fact, I think the problem is actually quite the reverse, which is or at least in some sense of the reverse, most military forces actually don't get out at all. There are massive restrictions on getting off of whether it's forward operating bases or bases in general. So most military forces and actually civilian government officials in Afghanistan never get off the base at all or rarely ever get off the base. On the Taliban in general, what you see over the course of the 1990s is, as you rightly point out, they were able to provide security and a sense of justice. But if you track their movement across Afghanistan from about 1994 to the late 1990s, you see they were able to militarily conquer Kandahar, then Herat in the west, then Kabul, and then a number of the northern cities like Mazar-e-Sharif and Kunduz. So it was certainly a combination of establishing law and order, their version of order, as well as winning on the battlefield.
Just about 5 minutes left in this part of the show. Anybody who has just tuned in, you're listening to Seth Jones. He's a political scientist who works for the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C., and we are talking about Afghanistan. Just to go back to the point that you mentioned or something that you said in response to the caller, and I just wanted to sort of underline this. You believe that as far as the leadership of the Taliban is concerned, that their ultimate goal would be to take control again, to reinstitute the regime that they had before?
Oh, there's no question that the leadership of virtually all the major insurgent groups, especially the Taliban, would like to overthrow the Karzai government and in its place set up a system, a political, religious, social system that was comparable to what was established in the 1990s. That is their version of Sharia in Afghanistan, and you know, we can actually see what it looks like because they ban music, ban kites. And so we've seen in areas of the federally administered tribal areas where the Taliban has taken control, those exact things have happened. There's a significant increase in the number of burqas that are worn. Music has been banned in a range of places. Kites have been prohibited. You see a very similar ideology that's been instituted in areas that they control. So there's no question they would push to do exactly that that in a future Afghanistan that they controlled.
Way back at the beginning of the program, you were talking about one of the problems here was the levels of support committed to assisting in the rebuilding of Afghanistan from outside the country, perhaps not what they could be or should be. And certainly that there was a kind of elaborate structure for doing the rebuilding and for different countries having responsibility for different sorts of things. The United States, they were going to rebuild the army, and Germany was in charge of rebuilding the police. And the UK was, their mission was to deal with the issue of narcotics and so forth. And certainly some criticism, I'm sure, has come from people here in the United States of these governments and their lack of enthusiasm for the military mission, and that's pretty much fallen on the United States and on Canada. And some others. But have they, in fact, really even followed through on their commitment to the various facets of the rebuilding that each of these countries and each of these governments said, yes, we're willing to do that thing?
Well, this is a really good question, because it turns out that one of the biggest problems in the whole reconstruction and development phase in Afghanistan is that coordination across countries has been fairly abysmal. So what you had, as you rightly described, is what was called a lead nation approach. So the Italians committed, for example, to coordinate the justice system. And, you know, you had a range of countries, international organizations, non-governmental organizations that were involved in various aspects of the justice system. Well, you know, the end result was pretty poor. There was little done, massive corruption. World Bank continues to put Afghanistan's justice system as one of the worst justice systems in the world. So I think using examples like that, this lead nation effort failed. The Italians were not able, for better or worse, to improve the justice system, and we were not able to coordinate across a range of different organizations. But it has been a problem across virtually all sectors: the police, counter-narcotics, the disbandment of militias. It's been a problem in coordinating across a range of agencies.
And does some of that, though, perhaps reflect, as some callers would suggest, that in some of these countries, the popular support for their governments being involved just isn't there?
Well, I think there is no question that is true. I think with countries like Canada, with countries like the Netherlands, there are Canadian and Dutch military forces operating in Afghanistan. The governments appear strongly to be supportive, but there are major questions within the Canadian public and within the Dutch public, and certainly within other European publics like the Germans, about how much of a national security interest does their country have in Afghanistan? And also, as part of that, should their military forces be engaged in combat missions? And this certainly has impacted the German unwillingness to provide forces to the south. The population has just not been supportive of it.
Well, we have maybe about a minute or two left. We know that one way or another we're going to have a new president. We don't know who that's going to be, but, well, it's either going to be Barack Obama or John McCain. So here we're going to have a new president. We're going to have a new administration. Based on the kinds of things that they have said so far, would you expect, no matter who is elected, that the policy here of the United States is going to be dramatically different than it's been in the past?
Well, I think for the first year or two of either administration, I do think there's likely to be a strong focus on Iraq. And even if Obama wins and he decides to downsize U.S. forces in Iraq and to gear up in Afghanistan for some period of time, I think there's going to be a focus then on strategies and policies in Iraq either way. So I think you may have, with an Obama team, a slight more emphasis on Afghanistan. I do think the Iraq focus will continue either way. And so in that sense, it's going to be difficult, I think, to spend a lot of resources and attention on the Afghan-Pakistan front.
Well, our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Seth Jones. He's a political scientist who works for the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to find out more about RAND, you can go to their website, which is www.rand.org. And Dr. Jones, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Also, our thanks to Jessica Goldings, who is providing the technical support on the other end of our connection here with RAND in Washington.